Coming up on this week's episode of TechSnap, we get to take a peek inside some never-before-seen data centers and see what makes them unique. Plus, a major flaw was found that affects some Intel CPUs, and some big mysteries have been answered around the Flame malware. Plus, we've got a great Q&A segment, and we've got some follow-up to some stories you're not going to want to miss. All that and more in this week's episode of TechSnap. Hi, everyone, and welcome to TechSnap. This is episode 63 of Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly Systems Network and Administration podcast. This episode is brought to you by GoDaddy.com, and the live stream is powered by ScaleEngine.com. We streamed this episode live on June 21st, 2012. My name is Chris, and joining this week is our host, the admin, the tech, and the teacher, Alan Jude. Hey there, Alan.
Hey, Chris, everybody. Thanks for watching.
Hey, man, 63 of these suckers. Good on you. Yeah. Good on you, sir. And
63 in a row. We never miss one.
I know. And it is a really big show today. And I'm sorry I always say that, everybody, but I don't think we've had this big of a news lineup in weeks. It is huge. It's packed. Plus, we've got a ton of good stuff in the roundup. And at the end of the feedback segment today, which we've got three really great feedback questions, I'm going to make an announcement about a new project being launched here at Jupiter Broadcasting that I want to get everybody's input on. Something really, really excited about, and it's really going to involve the community, and I'll tell you about that at the end of the feedback segment.
Yeah. It's just interesting, because as I was going through my pin board for the week, I was like, wow, I don't have that much in here. And then I write the dog, and I was like, oh, well, there's lots.
Yeah, it's funny, too. It's been an interesting...
Usually there's a lot of stories that we just don't end up using, and this week there was mostly just ones we did.
Yeah, they're all really good stories, and I went to the Reddit this week to, you know, really go through and see what they had all lined up, and I was like, yep, that's a great story, that's a great story. Before we get rolling on to all of that, just want to give people a quick reminder that this show is powered by your use of our affiliate links. If you go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com and you scroll all the way down to the very bottom of the site, it's kind of cut off here on this here monitor, but if you go all the way down there, trust me when I say there are affiliate links that if you use those, a little portion of your shopping session from those sites is contributed to Jupiter Broadcasting, and they help keep these shows on the air. All right, yep. Alan, why don't we kick off our first story? It's a big update on the whole Flame virus storyline, one that is right about on schedule, I believe. When we first covered this, I said, give it about 2-3 weeks, and we'll have the source of who they think it came from. And now, here we are, the Washington Post.
Well, this one is coming from a bit of a different angle, though.
Okay. But is this confirmed? Because I've seen the Washington Post report this.
Not officially confirmed. No one's admitting it.
Okay. That's not too surprising, is it? Okay, so what's going on?
Right. So the Washington Post and the New York Times suggest that the Flame malware was created by the U.S. and Israel, and they, under the assumption, they've already pretty much assumed that Stuxnet was too. So basically, the New York Times story is based on interviews with former Bush and Obama administration officials, so people that used to work in the administration and would actually know about these things.
That's a decent source, I got to say.
Yes. And so rather than, you know, the way we were expecting to find out where this came from was, you know, companies like F-Secure and Symantec and TrendNet and so on, reverse engineering the malware and finding signs of where it may have come from.
But didn't we see a story from Kaspersky that said, wait a minute here, we see code that is shared between, remember we covered in the roundup last week?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So we've had Kaspersky make that kind of connection, and now this is like
between
a totally different...
And this one is saying, you know, basically from leaked documents, they have enough evidence to say that Stuxnet was definitely the U.S. government.
Well, that kind of makes it like
so
a double-blind confirm in a way then, because you have two different
almost.
Ways
yeah,
of confirming
two different
it.
Sources of information, and they're quite disparate. Some of the officials that did comment on Operation Olympic Games, which was the original idea to use cyber warfare against Iran and was started under George W. Bush.
Right.
American officials say that Flame was not part of Operation Olympic Games, but just because it wasn't part of the operation that spawned Stuxnet doesn't mean it wasn't part of a successive operation that happened later. or a separate operation by a different agency of the government or whatever.
It's interesting because so we're talking about some very sophisticated cyber warfare programs that were being created in Bush's era. And yep. I got to say, I don't think the general population, like folks like you and I, really appreciated the level of, at which they're playing at. It's almost like when we watch the Senate and congressmen like trip over themselves talking about SOPA, we just kind of assume the whole United States government is inept technology, when in reality, before even any of that stuff was going on, they were building some of the most sophisticated malware ever to exist.
Yep. And so basically, when Obama took office, the New York Times basically says that he ordered the program to be stepped up and to get a lot more serious about it.
Fire up. All right. Okay, sure. Why not, right?
So officials have declined to say whether the U.S. Was responsible for the flame attack or not, but they're not denying it either. So you can read into that what you wish.
Right.
Although from reports from people that were actually in the Situation Room when Stuxnet started to get out of control and affect things outside of Iran, they say that Obama repeatedly expressed concerns that any American acknowledgement that it was using cyber weapons would enable other countries or hackers to justify their own attacks against targets.
So that shows that they knew what kind of Pandora's box they were opening.
Kind of, yeah.
Hmm.
And so this story has kind of drawn attention from a couple of different people. One of them is Bruce Schneier, who's a computer science, computer security expert, but he's also kind of branched out into just general security and cybersecurity and anti-terrorism and so on. And he says that basically cyber warfare is a destabilizing and dangerous concept.
Yeah.
It's kind of is. So if you compare, say, the 2007 Israeli attack against the Syrian nuclear facility to using Stuxnet to accomplish the same goal, Stuxnet didn't result in the loss of any life, and there was no risk to friendly personnel, whereas if you fly planes into an enemy country, there's the chance they'll get shot down or whatever. However, Stuxnet has damaged the U.S.'s credibility as far as being a fair arbiter or a force for peace in cyberspace. Right? And it,
right. We can't go out there and condemn China for attacking different infrastructure when we've been going after some of the most critical kinds of infrastructure that exist.
And its effects will be felt as other countries ramp up their offensive cyberspace capabilities in response to, right? It's basically a new nuclear arms race.
The other thing I worry is how much of this code has been developed by general contractors that could then be hired by somebody else. And you know, it's like you sort of are we priming an industry to serve? Are we sort of priming a new, instead of a missile industry, now we're priming a cyber warfare contractor industry where they can be hired to write some sort of program to meet their specifications, and then the next government that wants to do it hires the same group, and it just sort of grows from there. We could be looking at future Blackwater type scenarios.
Yep. And, you know, it's like the offensive use of cyber weapons is opening a Pandora's box, and it weakens the U.S.'s long-term position as far as trying to keep the internet free and open and so on.
Yeah.
And it trades off a short-term gain against Iran against a long-term detriment as far as their reputation and their position as a moral high ground or whatever.
Right.
You know, so the question is, has Stuxnet and Flame already destroyed the U.S.'s credibility as a leader for a free and open internet?
Right, and I think, I don't know if it made it to the roundup or not, but there's a story that came up this week that documents have been leaked. I think, it made it to the roundup. Yep. Documents leaked the U.N.'s trying to grab power over different aspects of the internet, and this, yep. I mean, you look at this, you could claim the U.S. has launched one of the most destabilizing attacks over the internet, and they have some good argumenting ground to stand on.
The problem with the U.N. proposal is that it has a bunch of things in it, like allowing countries to control their part of the internet, as far as
eavesdropping. And monitor communications,
But also taxes on data going into other countries based on the old system they had for telephone calls.
Oh, my gosh.
So a tariff. So basically, like, Google would have to pay to send data into Russia. And that would just break the whole internet. because the internet is based on the transit providers doing that.
Well, no, we just covered it. We don't have to cover it in the roundup now. That's basically it, right?
Well, the link's there, and yeah. we can talk yeah. more
no,
about it.
No, but it's that's disturbing.
Yeah. So another person who commented on the story was Richard Clark. We've talked about him before because he wrote a book called Cyberwar.
Right.
But he was the former National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism.
But under, now he works for a cybersecurity for hire firm now, right? That's what he does now.
For or started? I forget.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he might have started it. Yeah, you're right.
But basically, he contends that there's a firm distinction between cyber espionage and offensive cyber attacks.
Well...
So basically, what he's saying is... It's okay to spy on stuff, like passively reading data and trying to decrypt it and so on. But it's not okay to attack systems and infest them with malware and try to steal or erase data. So basically, and it kind of has analogies to the real world, right? Every country assumes every other country is trying to spy on them.
Right.
But... they don't assume every country is trying to plant bombs in their country or whatever.
You know, not to get very political on it, but then I think about it, too, from one perspective is that maybe it's kind of where Richard Clark is coming from, is wouldn't you rather the U.S. If Iran was trying to enrich uranium or whatever it is they were trying to do to make a weapon, wouldn't you rather the U.S. unleash a cyber virus, some sort of cyber warfare? I hate that term, but you know, malware to disrupt the facility instead of murdering more scientists or dropping bombs. I mean, there it seems more of a moral type of attack in a sense because it's
right.
It's less destructive.
Basically, you know, it is the same in a political sense as bombing the country. And so you can't try to claim that, you know, it's an innocent thing to do kind of a thing.
Good point. Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
You can't
right.
be attacking another country and not right. declaring war
it's
on
it. It's definitely an aggressive act.
Right. Whereas espionage is more passive.
Monitoring.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's just...
So you would almost think then espionage is a lesser of two evils.
Well, basically, yeah, espionage is going to happen. And that's everybody just accepts that. But attacks, you know, that requires retaliation.
I agree with Feather in the chat room. I'd just rather the U.S. do nothing. You know what I'm saying?
Possibly.
Yeah.
So Clark argues that while cyber espionage should be considered like regular espionage, routine, acceptable practice of any country as part of the governmental intelligence operations, cyber attacks are much more grave and should be considered on par with a physical attack into another country. Right, this goes back to, it was many, many episodes ago, but we talked about when the U.S. Came up with their rules that basically said, if you attack us with cyber weapons, we will respond with real weapons.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah, and it comes down to that. So if the U.S. is attacking countries with cyber weapons, they have to expect to receive a response in actual weapons. And that's different than just espionage.
Pretty interesting times.
Clark and a bunch of others also argue for basically an international cyber weapons arm control treaty, kind of like we have for missiles, saying, you know, these countries agree not to use them against each other or not to actively develop them or not to do hostile things on the internet.
Interesting. Boy, I bet that's coming. I bet something like that's coming.
And, you know, because of the speed of international diplomacy, it will take a while to happen. So... it's better to start sooner.
Yeah.
Before, and also before a certain country maybe gets too far ahead of everybody or something.
Any other thoughts?
That's what I just have an extra link to a story from about 2 months ago by Richard Clark on, I think we covered it, but I added the link again anyway, on how China steals the secrets.
This next story that's in here, Alan, sort of was like, what? And so I'm glad you have it in here so you can give us some more background. Yep. But the headline essentially reads as this. There is some sort of flaw in Intel chips with their x64 implementation that could be exploited on like Windows and other operating systems to do privilege escalations.
Yeah.
Like at a CPU level flaw?
Yes and no. So the issue surrounds the processor instruction sysret,
yeah.
which is basically how you return from an escalated system privilege operation, right? Because CPUs run on a ring architecture. So this is from the AMD 64 processor instruction set.
Right.
The instruction set was implemented, basically, Intel implements AMD 64 their own way, right? It's a standard, but they implement it their way. And basically, they do it slightly differently for this one command. And so some implementations, notably Microsoft, FreeBSD, and Xen, they read the AMD specification and implemented that. And then later, Intel made their AMD 64 chips, and they used that command slightly differently. And basically because of that...
I love it. Intel's like, hey, thanks for that awesome code that's going to really help us bridge our processors to the next generation. Saved us a ton, but we're going to do it differently.
Well, no, it's just that they didn't get the code per se. They got a list of specifications.
Yeah,
and they implemented it differently, and so the result can be slightly different.
All right.
Basically, there's a mismatch between what the expected behavior is and what actually happens that could lead to privilege escalation. So I have the statements in here from a bunch of the companies. Like Microsoft says that an attacker who successfully exploits this vulnerability could run arbitrary code in kernel mode.
Ooh.
So they could rootkit the machine.
Rootkit, yep, definitely.
So an attacker could install programs, view, change, or delete data, create new accounts with full administrative rights, and so on.
Hmm.
However, in FreeBSD's statement, successful exploitation of this problem can lead to local kernel privilege escalation, kernel data corruption, or a crash.
Yikes.
But for both of these, to exploit this vulnerability, an attacker must be able to run code with user privileges on the target system. So for Microsoft and FreeBSD, in order to exploit this, you have to be able to log in as a user to run the exploit.
Okay.
So it can't be exploited remotely against a machine that you don't have access to.
This is good.
Yeah. But also Xen, for their Xen server, when you're using it for paravirtualization, 64-bit paravirtualized guests could do privilege escalation into the host.
Oh, wow.
This issue only impacts servers running an Intel processor and could permit a 64-bit PV guest to compromise the Xen host server.
Now, this is...
Or Xen server host.
This is always the big fear. I mean, we've gotten a lot of emails that people say, could I put my firewall in a virtual machine? Is that secure? You know, a lot of things like that because... And the statement always is, well, virtual machines have been pretty secure, but if something could leap from a guest to a host or vice versa...
Yeah,
that's major.
So this one could allow the kernel privilege escalation to happen in the guest, but actually affect the host.
That is significant.
This is one where a denial of service could happen. So one of the guests could basically bring the whole machine down by just constantly hammering this. Or where a guest could somehow spoof the control interface so that when you connected with Xen Center to control the Xen server... It would actually connect to the one inside the virtual machine. So you could basically be tricked into possibly disclosing your authentication stuff to a guest instead of the host.
And how does the physical access requirement play out? Like, could I be SSH'd with root credentials to a machine and just execute a local executable on there that runs on the box?
If you're any user, you don't need root. If you have user access to the machine, you could run the exploit and become root.
So that's what you really mean by physical access, is you need to be able to execute code.
I didn't say
code.
Physical access.
Oh, okay. I was reading the chat.
What I said is you have to have a user, basically.
Right. So, boy. So
if you have SSH access to a machine, then as just a regular user, non-root, then with if you successfully exploit this, you could run code as root.
Wow.
And then, give yourself root, basically.
Wow.
Now, Intel's statement on the thing is, this is a software implementation issue. Intel's processors are functioning as per specification, and this behavior is correctly documented in the Intel R64 Software Developer's Manual, Volume 2B, page 4-598 and 599.
Wait, a.k.a. this is a problem we already knew about?
No.
Okay.
The function works the way they say it does in their documentation. The issue is Microsoft and FreeBSD and Xen assumed it worked the same way that AMD's did.
So
Intel says it works the way we want it to work. You just didn't read our documentation.
That sucks.
So go read page 598 and 599 in volume 2B, section 4.
So that's why it's such an interesting selection of operating systems. Okay.
Yeah. And it's because basically it depends how you implemented this.
I love it. The chat room, Intel's official response is RTFM. Very true.
So AMD's statement is, AMD's processor's sysret behavior is such that a non-canonical address in RCX does not generate a pound GP while in CPL 0. I have no idea what the hell that means.
So we cover it.
We have verified this with our architecture team and our design team, and we have performed tests to verify this on the silicon. Therefore, this privilege escalation exposure is not applicable to any AMD processor.
Okay. There you go. So we're talking Windows 2008. We're talking Windows 7. We're talking NetBSD, FreeBSD.
Yeah.
But not Linux or OS X as far as we know.
Right.
There you go. Wow.
Because OS X uses a different kernel. Mm-hmm. So they don't use the sysret code from FreeBSD. Anyway, FreeBSD had a patch out for this before the flaw was disclosed.
Oh, okay. So they got in on it early and they just whipped something right together.
Yep. Although they made a mistake with the version for FreeBSD 8.1 and had to do a revision.
Table flip, Alan. Table flip.
Right. Well, they fixed it right away.
Oh, okay. All right.
And not many people run 8.1 because it's rather old and it's not supported, or it's barely supported anymore. End of life is coming very soon, so people probably should upgrade to a newer version than 8.1 anyway, mm-hmm. considering 8.4 is already out. And 8.1 is like 3 years old now.
I have
some extra links on it.
I saw you had another alternative take on the disclosure, which had some
interesting things. Red Hat has a notice about this, but it's only for the Zen part because Linux isn't vulnerable.
Okay, right. Yeah. Okay, should we move on to the next story?
Yep.
Fujitsu made the headlines this week. Of course, I don't know for what, but maybe you're going to tell me. Why is Fujitsu in the headlines in our neck of the woods?
So a team at Fujitsu working in partnership with the Japanese National Institute for Information and Communication Technologies and Kyushu University have successfully cracked a 923-bit pairing-based cryptography message in only 148.2 days.
Wow. Did they use some sort of super system? I mean,
they used 21 desktop computers with 12 cores each.
Alan, what temperature is it at your house right now?
28.2. It's gone up 2 whole degrees Celsius since we started the show.
Wait, so what's that in Fahrenheit? I'm sorry. Is that like 80 something?
Not quite.
That because man, you look warm right now. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to disrupt you. You look 80? Really.
82.7.
Okay. You look really warm. But all right. So sorry to interrupt. So they use just a bunch of desktop cores to do this.
Well, 12 cores is a lot of cores. But yeah, they're basically off-the-shelf machines.
Yeah, but geez, you can get machines with Xeons in them that can rock 12 cores.
Yep.
Wow.
Based on previous results from cracking a smaller key size, they estimated that it should take several hundred thousand years to break a 923-bit key. So basically, they've discovered a new cryptanalysis attack against this type of cryptography, which is a system they're proposing to replace public-private key cryptography.
Huh.
And it also supports something called identity-based cryptography, where with the current public key system, you have to somehow publish your public key somewhere. With identity-based, your public key would be based on something that identifies you, like your email address.
Or a urine sample.
No, like your email address.
Oh, okay, all right, okay. Closing, I got that. I can give that to you. Internet. That's fine. I got plenty of both.
Yeah. So while this doesn't mean that the security of pairing-based cryptography is entirely broken, it just means that you need to use a much larger key size, right? Like we know with RSA and cryptography that you don't want to use a key of only 128 bits anymore, 1024 bits. You want a larger key, right?
Yeah.
SSL requires at least 2048 bit now.
2048 bit.
But this type of research is why only open cryptography standards should ever be trusted. And it's why it also takes so long to select a new standard.
Hmm.
Right? This is why we can trust things like AES, because they're open and there are researchers like these people working all the time to try to break
beating
them.
It. Yeah, yeah.
A lot of these standards have a cash prize for details on how to break them.
Good point.
RSA used to have a contest for a bunch of that. They've closed it down since then. But they would award cash prizes every time somebody broke the next highest level.
Yeah. Huh.
So as an example of that, there's the competition for the SHA-3 algorithm, which is the one that will replace SHA-256 and 512, which are barely starting to be adopted now. But the idea is, you know, they have to have these ahead of time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But basically, the competition to select which algorithm will be called SHA-3 opened in 2007. And it's not expected to be completed until later this year. So, you know, the contest runs for more than 5 years. Because part of the contest is people trying to find problems with these algorithms. So more than 50 algorithms were entered into the contest, and at this point only 5 remain.
Only 5 stand. Oh man, you could have runnings and championship leaderboards.
Yeah. Among the rejected algorithms is MD6, the successor to MD5 from Ron S., one of the guys founder at RSA. Mm-hmm. But it had some... the main reason people liked it was... It used Merkle trees, which allowed it to break really long messages out to hash them across multiple cores.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
Based on the idea on news from Intel that, you know, in the future, computers will have 10,000 cores.
Yeah, we're not going much higher in clock rate. We're going more cores.
Yeah. And so, especially if you're going to move from, you know, single and double-digit cores into, like, 5 digits of cores, that like the graphics cards kind of are, then your hashing algorithm needs to start looking at that.
I attended an Intel conference 2 years ago, and they said that by 2013, we'll have 12-core desktop processors. Like, the standard, like, what we consider, like, the i7 and i5 standards right now will be, like... i5 will be 8 cores, and the i7 will be 12 cores.
I think you can get E5s up to 6 or 8 cores, and you can put 2, 4, or 8 of those in a machine. Yeah.
And then those also do hyper-threading, which then to the operating system looks like significantly more cores, double the cores. So so a 6-core processor can look like a 12-core processor to an operating system. So the way the kernel's divvying out... But that influences how the kernel divvies out tasks, you know?
Right,
so
exactly.
They have to kind of accommodate for it.
Yeah. But there were some speed problems and insufficient proof of its resilience against differential cryptanalysis. So they, not officially, but unofficially, withdrew it from the competition. But it's still a work in progress, and it may, you know, enter the competition for SHA-4, because that will probably start next year.
There you go. So it might be back for another extremely competitive round of crypto showdown.
And I also have a link to the paper from the NICT on that when they cracked the 676-bit cryptography, which is the step before this. But anyway, so it used to set a world record by cracking that large of a key in that little time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because
you said it was 923-bit, right?
Yeah, and the last one was 676-bit, and basically. You know, there's a huge order of magnitude between those two numbers, right? Each additional bit would be twice as hard.
For sure.
So this is a huge number of times harder, and they did it in less time.
For sure. That's cool. All right, dude, any other thoughts on that story?
No, I put the link to the paper in there because it has all kinds of formulas and graphs and stuff.
All righty then. Well, let's talk about our very own patron for this show. Every now and then... this website, datacenterknowledge.com, gets to do these behind-the-scenes tours. We've looked a little bit at Google, and there's another one they've peeled the curtain back for. But this week, they looked at GoDaddy. And so not only is GoDaddy the sponsor of this show, but they've been a company that I, as an IT person, have been very interested in exactly kind of how they've scaled from sort of the beginning all the way up to now. I mean, can you just imagine the amount of DNS requests and
SSL? For example, you know, the story, one of the little tidbits in the story there is that when the company started in 1997, their data center was in the closet at the CEO's ranch
in
Arizona or whatever.
Which kind of harkens back to like kind of how Google started. There's a lot of like a little startup element to it. And you and I have both had to scale things that have started very small that weren't expected to have to grow that fast and then had to grow them up. And so getting a look at how GoDaddy has done that is extremely interesting for me as an IT guy.
The interesting mix of as they started, they got bigger, they started leasing space, and then they got even bigger and they started building their own data centers, and how now they have this mix of their own data centers and leased space.
That's a good way
The inside their first own data center. In the first part of it, they reused the old telco equipment that was already there. But as they built out into the rest of the building, they got more and more density going. So in the first part of the building, they have about 100 watts per square foot, but by later in the building, they're up to 300 watts per square foot.
That's good. And yeah. You know what? I found
a lot more servers. Like they went from like 12 servers per rack to 42 servers per rack. And
well, that's what I was. There's what they're talking about, the rack stuff too. I mean, you know, your system scale engine, you're just adding servers all the time, and you might be able to relate to some of this. You're like, well, first we had a couple servers in one rack.
Yep.
And then as time went on, we had a couple of racks in the row. And then eventually we just bought the entire data center and we had all the servers. And it's like, and they just kept doing that. And then they realized, okay, well, now we have to go global and we have to get data centers everywhere. And it's a very interesting story. Yep.
So there's a link in here for a photo tour of part of their data center. Just some interesting photos, geek porn, as it were.
Yeah.
And then I have some really interesting numbers. GoDaddy is a register for over 52 million domain names. And I think that actually makes them bigger than the next 10 competitors put together.
Holy moly.
Yeah. They're way out in front of the person in second place and actually bigger than second through ninth place added together.
I think that's a testament to the fact that they kind of brought domains, buying.coms to people. They made it human.
When it first started, Network Solutions was the only place that sold .com names, and it was $70 for every 2 years.
Right. Quite the
premium. And then GoDaddy came on the scene with, $9.99.
Yeah.
And kind of just totally changed the market.
It looks like that. I love looking at the pictures.
Also, before GoDaddy, you didn't get email hosting for free with your thing. You didn't get web hosting. You didn't get DNS hosting.
Right.
And, GoDaddy offers all those.
In fact, GoDaddy is the sponsor of TechSnap, and they have an offer that is expiring at the end of June. So you've got just a little bit while longer to take advantage of it. If you want to get 3 months of economy hosting for $1.99. I mean, I'm talking, you could go and put a WordPress site on that. You could put a forum on there. It is a Linux box that you can load stuff on. $1.99 for 3 months. If you use our offer code 199TECH when you check out. That expires at the end of June, so you're going to need to jump on that soon. Also, going for a little while, if you want to get a .us domain for $3.99, these can be as high as $19.99. So if you want to get a .us for $3.99, use our code 399US4. 399US4 when you check out. And thank you to GoDaddy for sponsoring. Yep. I mean, how cool is that? They started as a little startup at Bob's Ranch in his closet.
They weren't exactly a startup. They were self-funded because... Well, Bob started, he had a financial company. He wrote software for...
And he sold it to Intuit.
And he sold it to Intuit.
Yeah.
And,
no, what I mean, though, is that they started... I didn't mean startup like in terms of a company. I mean startup in terms... I'm a tech guy.
They're just small. Yeah.
I mean in terms of infrastructure.
Right.
Like they started as this tiny infrastructure. They had to do something that we talk about all the time in Scale and Grow like that. And then by the end of it, now they're sponsoring the show, and now we're able to do the show because of it.
Yep. They are one of the biggest DNS hosts in the world because they host all these little domains that people don't have a different DNS host for, right? They don't have their own DNS servers, so they use GoDaddy's.
Right.
So the GoDaddy DNS infrastructure answers 10 billion DNS queries per day.
Billion!
10 billion DNS queries per day. That is a lot of DNS.
That is, yeah.
Also, because they're one of the biggest sellers of SSL certificates, their OCSP servers, which are how your browser checks the validity of a certificate, make sure it hasn't been revoked, and so on.
Right.
Their SSL infrastructure handles more than 1 billion requests per day, and they expect to see that number go way up as more and more sites adopt SSL.
Right, and they are.
Like, the EFS is pushing for SSL everywhere. And, things like even Twitter and Facebook and so on are moving towards having SSL now.
Right.
And, it keeps people from reading your stuff and make sure the site you're talking to is actually the site you think it is. And so, they expect that to only get worse or bigger. And so that's why they started deploying servers in other countries instead of just the U.S. to handle that load.
Mm-hmm.
They currently host more than 5 million websites on 35,000 servers.
35,000, Alan.
Yeah. A lot of servers. And that's just the ones for hosting. That doesn't count their servers they have for DNS and SSL and so on.
And their own infrastructure and all that.
Yep. They block 2.5 million brute force attacks every hour.
Brute force attack? I wonder what that means.
Like trying to break into email, FTP, or SSH. Or even just, web hosting.
Wow.
But
two
yeah, it's like
an hour, 2.5 yeah, million
like,
an hour.
POP3 accounts are really popular for people to try to hack against.
Sure.
Because a lot of people now have an app to defend their SSH port, but a lot of people forget about POP3. Because it's also it's completely unencrypted, and well, unless you use POP3 over SSL. But, you know, people tend to have really bad passwords on their email.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the people you would never trust with an SSH account still have an email account. You know, Bob in accounting has an email account with his password is BobBob123 or something. So yeah, they block 2.5 million brute force attacks every hour. They store more than 23 petabytes of data with all the web hosting clients.
Holy crap.
The virtual machines and everything else they host. And they process more than 350 million emails every day because of all the emails that they host.
Wow. Wow. And I know they run a ton of that stuff on Linux, too, which is awesome.
Yep.
That is really cool. All mm-hmm. right. Any other notes on that one?
No, that's about that one.
All right. Now we got one more. It's sort of some more data center porn, isn't it?
Yep.
All right. This is another datacenterknowledge.com article, too. So what do we got here?
So OVH, which is a very large server hosting ISP in France, has just deployed the world's largest data center in Canada.
Oh, your neck of the woods, Alan.
Yep, it's not that far away. It's in Quebec, but it makes sense because it's a French company. But basically, the new data center makes use of OVH's cube data center design, which is basically they build a cube and the center is hollow, and they put all the servers around the outside where they breathe in air from just like outside air.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay.
And the hot air is exhausted in the middle where it kind of goes up like a chimney.
They can do that, huh?
Now, their original worry with putting the servers in Canada is that the input air would be too cold, right? Because when it gets down to like, you know, minus 20 Celsius or whatever, that's below what the servers are rated for.
Yeah.
But
about humidity and things?
Right. So what it is the building they bought to put it in was an aluminum smelting plant. And so it had this same idea of this convection with sucking in outside air to vent the hot air. So they're going to build their cubes inside the existing building so that when the really cold air from outside comes in, they can preheat that slightly with the exhaust air from the servers.
Brilliant.
So that it's at a low but not too low temperature to cool the servers.
That is absolutely brilliant. And it'll dry it too.
Yeah. So, yeah, the cold air is inlet from the outside of the cube and then exhausted in the center of the cube where it then just vents outside.
And I noticed in their Fancy Pants video they have here, too, that they're using water cooling on the components.
Yes, they use water cooling on the servers, and so the block goes right on the CPU. And they found that saves as much as 30% on their energy bills. Because typically, with a server, say you have a 100-watt server, you normally need about 100 watts of air conditioning to cool all the heat that 100-watt server adds to the room.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're using water cooling, then you only need about 10 watts.
Significant.
So, yeah.
Especially when you're doing hundreds. What they talk about is 360,000 servers could go in there.
That's what makes this is going to be the biggest data center. Although, you know, they're starting with just 10,000.
Yeah.
But they have these little cubes, and they'll just keep adding more and more cubes up to 36 as many as they can fit.
This is really neat. And it also, I mean, remember when we talked about when we got a little peek inside Facebook's data center process and they were doing that, I forget where they're building it, but it was also bringing in outside air for cooling and they weren't going to be using air conditioning.
Because the other thing like Facebook is that OVH builds all their servers custom. Now they use some standard components from Supermicro and so on. But as you can see in those pictures, because they're doing the water cooling and so on, they actually have custom bits.
That's so neat.
Yeah, and so there's a video here that shows a bunch of the stuff where their stuff is in France and what's going on in Canada. But one of the other unique things about this data center is that it's actually built directly adjacent to the electrical substation for a hydroelectric dam.
Oh, that's
so it's
handy.
Right beside a renewable energy source.
That's handy.
Yeah, and so basically that dam will provide 120 megawatts of power to this plant because the aluminum smelting mill that was there was already designed to need that kind of power. And so they just reused the existing infrastructure.
Of course. And I assume, obviously, data connectivity is good and all those kinds of things to that area, too.
Yeah, it's kind of actually a good central location right between, like, New York, Chicago, and Toronto. So it gets you right into all the hotspots for the East Coast data networks.
Very nice. Oh, man, that is so cool. I love these next-generation data centers that are using way less power for cooling because as more and more things go into the cloud, we're going to have more and more data centers, and we don't want these things to become a massive drain on the power infrastructure.
Right. So. And yeah, the machines are getting more efficient, and they're getting more efficient ways to cool them. You know, they've almost completely done away with air conditioning at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, in my data center, they have a very small amount of air conditioning, and then the rest is chilled water cooling. So they get water really cold. Actually, most of what they do is they pump it out of a well on site because the water underground is already kind of cold.
Yeah.
Then they just pump that through, and then fans blow air over the cold water, and it
cools. Right, so it's a swamp. It's a swamp pump kind of whatever they call them, right? Swamp cooler. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they only have to cool the water during the summer because in the winter it's already cold.
Right, yeah.
Because Canada, after all.
Yeah, jeez. All right, well, other thoughts on that
and
one?
So, and then I have an extra link here that talks about how they made the decision to build it in Canada instead of they were looking at like Boston or Philadelphia originally.
Doesn't have anything to do with the Patriot Act, does it?
Not that they said.
Okay, because remember we did cover that one that was... Yeah.
Well, of course, a part of it was... You know, it's got to be easier for them being a French company that where end up putting the data center, the people speak French.
Yeah.
Or it's easy to hire people that speak both English and French in Quebec because it's Quebec.
Yeah. I would love to check it out. Maybe they'll release more photos and videos in the future. I'll keep an eye out. All right, Alan. With I think that means the news is all done, so it's time for the TechSnap feedback. Thanks for sending your emails to techsnap@jupiterbroadcasting.com or using the contact form that we have linked at the top of Jupiter Broadcasting. The first email, Alan, comes from Eric. Are you ready, sir?
Yep.
All right, here it goes. He says, hey, guys, I've been watching religiously since episode 15. Thanks, Eric. And he says, keep up the great discussions. My question is about Active Directory as a user database. It seems like nearly every leaked email username password hash list discussed on TechSnap seems to involve some sort of SQL system. So my company is moving heavily into Microsoft SharePoint for our public website. Oh my gosh. I know. I tried to steer them away, he says. Okay. Which uses Windows Server Active Directories for the user database. Now, taking Microsoft's CALS, that's Client Access License, completely out of the equation, is Active Directory a responsibility, a safe program for storing... A reasonably safe program for storing internet user credentials. I don't think I've ever had to look at a leaked story. Never heard it mentioned. That doesn't mean it's not happening. I look forward to your response, Eric. I got to get bigger text on that. I can't read that halfway across the room. So his question was: I think essentially, how does Active Directory encrypt its password? Is what it boils down to. And
is it a good thing to use for your website? For your website, I would say no. But if it's an intranet, like just a company SharePoint thing, then that might be okay. But I wouldn't want just every user registering into an Active Directory database.
You have to check your group policy settings. So go into your group policy settings, and I called out the option in the TechSnap show notes. You want to make sure that store passwords using reversible encryption is not enabled. You can actually, if you enable that, it's almost just like storing them in plain text. If that's turned off and you're running Windows 2000 Active Directory native or 2003 native Active Directory mode, or if you're on 2008 native Active Directory mode, Active Directory uses a combination of hashing for the password storage, not salting as far as I know, but hashing. And the other thing that they do that's kind of clever is they use a series of Kerberos tickets to verify your authentication. So the Windows machine... It logs in, and it sends – it never actually sends the password over the wire. It sends either a hash of the hash or it sends the hash to the server. Then the server gives your machine a token, and so that's one way that it kind of protects it. Is it doesn't actually transmit passwords over the wire, but then it does store them in a hashed database. Is that secure? What do you think, Alan?
It's hard to say. Part of – also the other thing is that because Active Directory – the way Active Directory is designed is that the Active Directory data store isn't readable except for by the trusted people. And, right. you know, if someone has physical access to the machine, then now that goes out the window. But
you have to be, to get that, to get even that far, to pull that down, you'd have to be authenticated as an administrator.
One of the main differences is with MySQL, you have just a username and password or whatever that are normally stored in the web app. Whereas with Active Directory, you know, the machine has to be part of the domain and you have to have an account in order to access it. Now, if you're giving read and write access to your Active Directory to a script in your website, this might not be a good idea, but it's basically, I'm not a domain expert on Windows. I don't know.
I did link in the show notes to a good thread on Stack Exchange where they explain the different types of encryptions that are available to Active Directory, because there's a couple different options depending on your settings.
Because even just for your local SAM database, like if you're using Windows XP, in Windows XP, the default was to support backwards compatibility with Windows 98.
Right.
So it would store your password in both the new and old format, unless you specifically disabled the old format. Now, the old format was just MD4, where it would take your password, split it into two chunks of 7 characters, therefore deleting any password, like ignoring the end of any password longer than 14 characters, and hash those two pieces separately. So meaning you can crack the first half and last half of the password at the same time. And it's an easy thing to rainbow table. You can get a single CD that will rainbow table almost any Windows password. If it's using NTLM V1.
Yeah, yeah.
Or
oh, yeah.
Also known as LM hash.
Yeah. All right. Should we move on to the next question, sir?
Yeah.
All right. This one comes from Frank. And Frank writes, hi, Alan and Chris. He says that I'm sometimes unsure whether I'm doing everything right concerning security. All I do for security is keep my stuff up to date. And that's basically it. If there's an extra bit of security that's necessary, I would also use virtualization to separate potential vulnerable areas of my server. So he's doing some nice, quote-unquote, physical separation. He says, blocking IP ranges also comes to mind for security, or applying patches, which makes some software more secure. But I really don't know what else I could be doing. What do you guys do for security? Same things, or do you do more? And also, he says, by the way, what's the main difference between Gen 2 normal and Gen 2 hardened? So the first part of his question is, what more could he be doing other than just applying security updates to stay secure?
Make sure you patch your stuff. Other things, he made a good point about compartmentalization. If you can virtualize stuff or put it in a jail or something, just to try to keep things as separate as possible so that if one thing does get breached, it doesn't affect everything. You know, make sure you have backups of everything. Everybody should access the machine with a separate username, so that your audit logs show who made a change or whose account was compromised.
And actually, why not move that on to, if possible, when possible, individual processes and services like Apache and MySQL, make sure they're running as their own user, and those are limited.
Have no more privileges than they need.
Right.
You know, do most of your work as a regular user, not as root or administrator.
Right. What about something like Tripwire or something like that?
Yep. Tripwire is a good host-based IDS. It's checking for modified files.
Yeah.
As for blocking IP ranges, I would recommend a more active response type of thing, like, you know, SSH guard or deny hosts or fail to ban that blocks people when they attempt to brute force your server.
Based on a pattern recognition kind of thing.
Rather than just saying, I'm going to try to block all IP addresses from China or something.
Yeah. I also would say, if you're really concerned about it, so say, you know, in Alan's case, Alan follows FreeBSD security advisories really closely. In my case,
there's a mailing list I subscribe to, and I get an email. Not just an email signed with a GPG key every time there's a vulnerability.
So then you kind of get a heads up, and you know, that'll even sometimes you can know when something's coming down the road. Also, watching shows like this, I mean, it sounds a little self-serving to say that, but I mean, we also kind of keep you up to date on what's coming on and give you tips and get you thinking about things. And just that kind of proactive thinking, the only way to really secure yourself is if you're familiar with the different methods, because then you can put yourself in their shoes and say, well, if I was trying to get in, what would I do? And then you can try to secure from that direction as well.
Yep.
So. All right, sir. Well, those are some good starting tips, and I'm sure we'll have more in the future. Should we ask ready for the next email?
Sure.
All righty then. Robert emails in. He says, hi, Chris and Alan. I have a problem that I was wondering if you could help me out with. We have a new product that our company has developed, and people are counting.
It's four people counting.
Four people counting system that connects over the internet to allow us and the customers to view the traffic. I am able to set up the product within our own network, i.e. I set up the time, server, its IP address, NetMask gateway, blah, blah, blah. This is fine as it allows me to check the system is actually working. What I want to do which I'm not sure if it's possible to do, is simulate someone else's network using different IPs, different information, different, you know, gateway, things like that. And in a lot of cases, I'll be dealing with dynamic IPs and not static IPs, which isn't as a problem, as I've also been able to set up DOI DNS to allow the customers to view and count the results. I have basic networking skills. Can you suggest a way to solve this or point me to a site I could look at? All the work is done under Ubuntu Linux 11.10, and I'll be upgrading 12.04 at some stage. Love TechSnap and Linux Action Show. Keep up the great work.
Now, I'm not entirely sure exactly what he's asking, but you could use virtualization to set up a bunch of machines in a different network, mm-hmm. right, with a different network. So, you know, you set one up as a router and then set up machines behind it and make sure you can get through it both ways or whatever and virtualize everything and create virtual networks.
And I would say don't use Ubuntu. If you're going to set up a virtual infrastructure, and we've actually talked about how to do this on TechSnap before, or maybe it was last, I can't remember. Use pfSense. Don't use like Ubuntu and spend an hour making Ubuntu a router. Just use something that's specific for it. Or set up a virtual machine and give it a dedicated NIC and actually plug that NIC into its own separate switch and just let like have that thing do DHCP and just set up a little network that way.
Right, but one way to do it in just virtualization is, you know, you set up a bunch of virtual NICs in VirtualBox or whatever and you say, all right, you bridge a bunch of machines to the same NIC as if that's to simulate all being on the same switch. Uh-huh. And then one of those machines will have one NIC in that virtual switch and a second NIC that is, say, bridged to your real network and has access to the internet. Yeah. And that's the one where you would install pfSense in the virtual machine.
Yep.
And then you can simulate it. You can use other IP subnets and so on. If you try to use other IP addresses if you try to use real internet IPs inside your network, you can do that, but you'd have to basically configure it properly so that they will see each other. And if you do that, you won't be able to reach the real IP addresses on the internet with it.
If he's really doing product testing for a product that their company is making, what I have had clients do is like if they have, back in the day, if they had a T1 or if they had primary internet, I would have them get the cheapest of whatever the other internet in their area was, because that's how it works around here. There's usually always two. So if they had cable, I'd have them buy a DSL line. And then test over the DSL line, because that truly is a completely separate network. But in this day and age, you could even do something like get a 4G hotspot like MiFi and connect to that and see if that lets you do it.
But really, in the end, it's just a matter of, you know, the product should work fine no matter what the IP addresses are. They're just numbers. I'm not sure exactly what it is he's trying to test to be able to answer the question.
I kind of grokked by reading through between the lines that I think he's really worried about somebody's got a dynamic DHCP ISP leased address, and they're behind some sort of clunky NAT router, and I think he's just worried that maybe you won't be able to connect through their NAT router through their firewall to their system or something. I don't know. But test it like that. Use virtualization. This is where virtualization can be a big help.
Yes, like that's why we did that. Like in the labs at the college where I used to teach, in the original setup, there were 9 rows of computers, and each row had a switch, just a little, you know, Linksys, you know, home switch. And then those were all trunked back. There was one server at the back of the room for each row that had 2 network cards. Hmm. The first network card would be connected to the switch in the row, so basically connected it to all the computers in the row. And then the second one was connected to a switch at the back of the room that eventually went out to the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the way the room was set up, there was a punch-down block, and you could switch the connection between the switches in the row to either go to the back of each of their individual servers or to go into that switch that goes to the internet. So in the first setup, all the machines in the room are just all connected into one switch and go out to the internet. In the second setup, once you move some cables around, each row is connected to only its server, and then that server is connected to the internet. Mm. And one of the labs would be set up your subnet in your row, and then go back to the server at the back and build a router and connect it to all the other rows.
And you couldn't just load pfSense.
One of the labs was actually to load pfSense and do it.
But oh, really?
One of
That's nice.
One of the labs was to do it all manually.
Okay, all right.
And to see how it works. But eventually, you know, the problem with that is people had to work as a group and not everybody got to do it, or some people would get to, like, you know, tag along and ride on coattails. So when I redesigned the class, I did it all in VirtualBox. So everybody would build the three machines in one virtual machine. So they'd have a client, and then a second a router and a second client, and then so basically instead of each row working together, each person did it themselves and had to connect to other people in their row or other rows.
Very slick.
So by using basically building a whole virtual network inside each machine was VirtualBox.
Mm-hmm. And that's what he could do. That's exactly what he could do.
Exactly.
Now, I've got an announcement to make, and it's funny because the chat room is right now talking about the BSD Bacon show, a Unix show, a Plan 9 action show. And so this announcement that I'm about to make will be right up their alley. On the last Linux action show, I reviewed a product called Airtime by a company called Source Fabric. Mm-hmm. And they saw the show and loved it and hooked me up with an Airtime Pro account. And Airtime is a fully automated internet radio station. So Jupiter Broadcasting is very seriously considering launching a 24/7 jblive.am stream, which we have now, but this would have completely original programming that'd be running on it 24/7. So not only our own shows, but other people in the community's podcasts, or people come on and do DJ mixes of Creative Commons music. We could have people that have maybe an existing podcast that has a little bit of a following, but they want a little more exposure. They could bring it on and they could broadcast on the radio show. I'm going to do blocks of old-time radio, so it'll be like the old-time radio hour, and we'll have like a couple old-time radio mysteries. We'll go through old sci-fi shows and things like that. And I'm taking DJ signups. Now, not everybody. It's going to be kind of small. It's going to start as kind of a small group of broadcasters, and we'll grow it over time. But if you might be interested in participating, go over to bit.ly/DJ Draft. I just put a link in the chat room, too. bit.ly/DJ Draft. And I have a questionnaire form over there that asks you a few things, like what your idea is and what kind of things you've done before, to essentially get the ball rolling. And I'll be taking submissions and then reviewing them and then contacting a few people to get this process started. But this Airtime software is super cool, Alan. It allows people to remotely broadcast very easily from their own house using open source software. And it's all based on a schedule system where you can have other hosts be connected, and it'll publish to SoundCloud after you're done with your show automatically. Nice. And all kinds of stuff. So I'm really excited. If you think you might have a great idea, or you have a podcast that you'd like to get a little more exposure, something like that, go over there, bit.ly/DJ Draft. Pretty exciting. I think people are really going to enjoy this thing. And we're going to try to do it so you can have a high-quality stream and a mobile stream, but that's all early days. This is definitely on the ground floor right now, but you'll be hearing more, and it'll be cool. It'll be something people can enjoy on the go or in their house. All right, Alan. Well, now with the feedback done, I think that means it's time for the TechSnap Roundup. And welcome to the TechSnap Roundup. Yeah, that's what that crazy music means. Now, the Roundup are stories that didn't quite make it into the top of the show and almost always are exclusively powered by links.techsnap.tv, our awesome TechSnap subreddit where you can submit stories to the show, questions, or just vote things up or down or leave comments. And Alan, our first story in the Roundup is breaking news, sir. Are you ready?
Yes.
Take it.
So I put this down here in the Roundup because I don't have enough details to actually make it a main story yet. But a hacker claims to have breached 79 different banks and acquired 50 gigabytes of customer data from them.
Yikes.
Now, most of the data seems to be Visa MasterCard data, and it includes a lot of personal information, enough that Visa said the data couldn't have been from them because they don't have that particular amount of data.
Huh.
Right? They don't keep all the Visa doesn't actually issue the card to you, so they don't keep all the data about you. It's more, you're bank issues the card to you and they know your address and so on.
Yeah.
And so Visa can definitely say the breach wasn't their network, but it could be somewhere else. There's also some suggestion that some of this data is old data that was either left laying around somewhere or is just compiled from old breaches that were leaked or whatever.
Right.
So we don't know that much about it, but there's a news story here and it seems like a lot of data.
And we'll probably have more next week if something interesting develops. Yep. All right. The next story on the Roundup is the FBI and DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, warn that IPv6 may be too damn anonymous, and they want the protocol adjusted.
Well, see, there's this one part of IPv6 that they're still working on specifically to be anonymous. Basically, you have an address range that's huge, and there's one part that's specifically about you getting anonymous address. So when you connect to a bunch of different sites, you would actually connect with different IP addresses in your IPv6 block.
Cool.
So that they wouldn't relate you.
I like that.
And actually, one of the talks I saw at BSDCAM was about a flaw he found where, you know, the way those addresses were generated, you could tell if two addresses were actually the same person or not. And so they were going to fix that to keep a level of anonymity up.
Righto.
And yes, it looks like the BSDCAM videos have finally been posted. It just seems that Dan forgot to tell me. Anyway,
maybe next week.
Maybe next week and starting soon after anyway, we will cover a bunch of the cool stuff that I saw there. And so I'll get to see some of the ones I missed.
So this has been a reoccurring topic. Are you ready to move on to the next one?
Yep.
This has been a reoccurring topic over the last few episodes, and that is specifically Firefox's local password storage.
Well, this isn't the local password storage.
No, but we hear...
The story is about Mozilla talking about the way that they do for their web services. They actually have a really cool method.
I think it's funny, though. I mean, here we are. It's our third week in, and we have another... Mozilla password-related story. Yes. All right, so what's going on?
So basically, they're talking about the LinkedIn and LastFM hacks. LinkedIn used just SHA-1, and it seems LastFM just used plain MD5, both of which are bad.
Uh-huh.
So they talk about what you should do, and you know, the problem with using just SHA is that SHA is designed to be fast, unless you use the cryptographic version where you do it 5,000 times. So what Mozilla does for theirs is they do a two-step process, actually. So the first thing they do is an HMAC, so HMAC, which is a hashed message authentication code. So basically what they do is the web servers have a salt that's specific to the machine, right? So they take your password, add the machine-specific salt, and calculate an HMAC of that. Then they use that as your password. Then they generate the salt and use the bcrypt, which is the Blowfish-based cryptographic algorithm. So they use that hashing algorithm, but first they HMAC the password with something specific from the web server.
Hmm.
So what that means is that in order to crack the password, if somebody steals the database with all the hashes in it, in order to try to brute force it, they also need the salt from the web server, which is a separate machine that they would have to break into. So unless they can break into both machines, they can't brute force the passwords.
Very cool.
So this is actually implementing what we saw Paul Honeycamp recommend of having something a little different. So basically, instead of just running bcrypt on the password, because bcrypt is one of the slow algorithms, right? It runs 2^7 times. So right, so it runs like, you know, 10 million times on your password.
Mm-hmm.
They do it so that they're using the HMAC first and basically double salted. Also, their article has a bunch of cool little labeled like MAME pictures.
Yeah, I did like that. I was showing one of them. All right. Now, we already talked about this one, so we can probably be pretty brief on it. But leaked documents show that the UN's internet power grab in there. Russia and some Arab countries are proposing to be able to inspect private communications such as email. Russia and Iran are also proposing new rules to measure internet traffic along national borders and bill the originator of the traffic as international phone calls, essentially creating a national toll booth for data, like you had mentioned.
Right. But, you know, the way the internet was designed with for example, Google pays a tier one provider to deliver their traffic to wherever, right? The way the internet works is you pay for the traffic when you upload it to the internet.
Right.
So the uploader pays. So Google's already paying a company to deliver the data to anywhere in the world.
Yep.
And that company then has some deal with, you know, a company in Russia to take the data. And if the government decides to try to charge money at the border, the very first problem with this thing is that it would mean the Russians would have to install something to count the packets as they went through. And if they can count them, they can do other things to them.
All right, sir. It's the roundup. We're supposed to move on. Are you ready for the next story?
Yes.
So this one's interesting. Apple patent polluting Facebook. Something about patents and streams.
Yes, so
and how does Apple have anything to do with social network statuses? That's just crazy.
So Apple has got a patent for a system to pollute Facebook pages with false data.
Wait, Apple?
Yes.
Apple has a patent? No. No.
So basically, Apple's patented this process they developed to basically post phony stuff to Facebook and Google Plus in order to hamper data mining. I'm not entirely sure what the goal is. Like, if it posts as you, and then people have to try to figure out which posts are real and which ones aren't, it's not very useful. But I guess the general idea is to make it easier to anonymize your data while still using something like Facebook.
Sort of randomizing it with noise, in a way.
Apparently, yeah.
All right, well, the next story is just a quick announcement for LastPass, folks, because I love LastPass. LastPass 2.0 has been released. One of the interesting things they're doing now, which I didn't really expect to come from them, is document storage, including some other kinds of storage, like other things that I'm not quite sure I haven't read into yet. But I've updated on all my machines, and it's rocking. And I don't use the document storage yet, but I love it for the password storage. And like we always recommend, use different passwords for every website you visit. And LastPass,
every single site needs a unique, strong password.
Now, some news about SSD prices, right, Alan?
Yes. So we talked about the other week how the prices of spinning hard drives haven't really gone down after the price spike.
From the floods.
From the floods. But yeah. Over at Tech Report, they have a bunch of interesting graphs about the price changes in different SSDs.
Oh, okay.
Now, Intel really hasn't dropped their prices much, but a lot of the other vendors like Corsair and OCZ and so on have lowered their prices.
Yeah, to compete with Intel.
In general, the price per gigabyte has fallen about 46% since the beginning of 2011.
I mean, Intel, you know, came out as, okay, these are really good SSDs, and they got to get the premium price point.
Their first gen ones with the SLC instead of MLC, they were rather expensive. I paid almost $500 for 32 gigabytes, but they were... That was the only way to get the speed and the durability. Now you can get the speed, but you still can't get that level of durability without paying that kind of price.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. All right. Well, moving on to the next story in the roundup. What is the next story? Oh, another data center look. I was like, no, we've already covered this one. But no, this is another story from datacenterknowledge.com. And everybody needs a data center, right, Alan?
Yep. Well, this is just a model.
Yeah. It's a Lego data center, and it's actually kind of a clever idea if you could build it so that it actually represented your work. This is kind of a neat way to visualize what you need to do. This is pretty cool, little project.
So, basically, he built a data center out of Lego. He uses about 5,700 pieces of Lego. Has 28 different minifigs, which are just the little Lego people. Uses one light brick, and it uses about a meter of fiber optic cable.
That's pretty cool.
The instructions for building it are on the Lego site, I think.
Oh my gosh, really? So like if somebody wanted to build their own?
Yep. There's also separately, somebody built a Turing machine out of Lego. If you want to see, which is like a practical demonstration of how a CPU actually works inside.
Yeah, yeah.
And someone built one out of a single set of the Lego Mindstorm stuff.
Wow, you can do anything with Legos. You can do anything with Legos, Alan. Mm-hmm. That's insane. Well, there you go. I think you made it. I think you survived to the very end of the show. Are you going to like just blast the AC now that we're done?
Pretty much.
Yeah. All right. I've got to give a quick plug. If you love TechSnap, you love Linux Action Show and things like that, go check out the brand new show we have over at jupiterbroadcasting.com. Very excited about this. Coder Radio, episode 2 is just out, and episode 3 will be live Monday at 9 a.m. Pacific at noon Eastern. And this week we talked from a different perspective than I think you hear anywhere else about some of the things that came out of WWDC. And then, of course, the next coming weeks is Google I.O., which is going to be crazy. Tons of Android stuff, tons of HTML5 stuff. Coder Radio will be covering all of that stuff. So go check out the new show. You know what? Heck, I'll put a link to that in the chat room too for the fine folks. And all right, Alan.
Yes,
well, I think that's the whole show, yeah?
Stay tuned for upcoming TechSnap because we're going to talk about some of the cool stuff we saw at BSDCAN. Including, specifically, there was the really good talk about IPv6 and some of the security implications of IPv6 and the fact that everybody's always thought about security in terms of IPv4 and how does it translate.
Right. Interesting. Germane to what we talked about today. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, TechSnap is live every Thursday afternoon at 1 p.m. Pacific, which is
4 p.m. Eastern, 2000 UTC.
There you go. And we encourage you to join us live over at jblive.tv or the audio stream, which is going to get a lot fancier over the next few weeks over at jblive.am. All right, everyone. Well, thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of TechSnap, and we'll see you right back here next week.